This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Tuesday, April the 7th, 2026. As always, we'll start in the world section of today's monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, first up from today's world section of the Christian Science Monitor, is the following headline. In Hungary's elections, the war in Ukraine looms large. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is turning to a familiar boogeyman on the campaign trail, the war in Ukraine and the danger he claims it poses. The date on this article is April the 6th. It is by Dominique Sogoy, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and the dateline is Győr, Hungary. As Hungarians head toward primary parliamentary elections on April 12th, the war in next-door Ukraine looms large. Posters of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky are so ubiquitous across Hungary that one would be forgiven for thinking he is on the ballot. That's because Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his ruling Fidesz party are framing the election as a choice between security and peace under his leadership or the possibility of Hungary being dragged into the war between Russia and Ukraine, possibly by seeing its EU-allocated money tapped to fund the conflict, or worse, being caught up directly in the fighting if it expands. In 2026, we and only we are capable of saying no to the Ukrainians to preserve Hungary's peace, security, and the possibility of economic development, Mr. Orban told a crowd of devoted, flag-waving supporters in Győr, a Western industrial hub and key electoral battleground. Many attendees held signs bearing the names of the smaller villages from which they had traveled. Dear Ukrainians, we will not ruin Hungary for your sake. The Prime Minister continued, we will not give up our children, we will not give up our sons, our weapons, and we will not give up our money either. Fidesz's central campaign argument asserts that Ukraine's security and economic stability depend entirely on staying out of the war in Ukraine. It leverages a deeply ingrained national narrative of resisting foreign domination, including Soviet rule, by framing Hungarian pushback against demands from Ukraine and the European Union as defensive sovereignty. But for many voters, Mr. Orban's position appears increasingly at odds with reality, and his message just isn't getting through to voters beyond the core Fidesz supporters. Orban's touring is not working so well, says Stefano Bottoni, a historian who published a biography on the leader. Many people who go to rallies just go there to whistle or to do catastrophic tourism just to see what happens, like in a movie. Orban is used to mastering the masses, and it is not working anymore. Hungary has often broken ranks with the EU on support for Ukraine, opposing or delaying both sanctions against Russia and aid packages for Ukraine. It has pushed for a non-escalatory approach with Moscow, a stance shaped in part by Hungary's heavy reliance on Russian energy imports. The EU is withholding billions in funds for Budapest due to concerns over rule of law, corruption, and democratic backsliding. Hungary and Ukraine are also at odds, with the leaders of both nations regularly trading barbs. On Sunday, Mr. Orban and the president of Serbia announced that explosives were found near a pipeline in Serbia that transports Russian natural gas to Ukraine. Mr. Orban said that, quote, there was an act of sabotage prepared, end quote, and noted that Ukraine has been trying for years to cut off Europe from Russian energy, though he did not directly blame Ukraine for the alleged incident. Ukraine denies any involvement and said the incident was likely a false flag operation intended to affect Hungary's elections. Those geopolitical frictions have made the war into a central campaign issue, say observers. The issue of the war is a major theme in the campaign and divides the electorate, explains Agoston Mraz, chief executive officer at Nezopont Interzet, a Budapest-based government-affiliated research institute. The institute has forecast victory for Mr. Orban and Fidesz, though many independent pollsters show the public favoring challenger Péter Magyar, a conservative and former government insider, and his Tisza party. Those supporting the governmental party believe that if Magyar becomes prime minister, the new government will give a green light to sending funds and European troops to aid Ukraine, says Mr. Mraz, whereas the voters of the opposition are less aware of this and are clearly backing Ukraine's war effort and its potential EU membership. The tension is palpable at campaign rallies. In Gyor, faithful Fidesz voters bickered with disenchanted but cosmopolitan teens who dared boo the ruling party. "It is either a Hungarian government or a Ukrainian government," snapped an older lady dressed in white, denouncing the opposition. "Tisza is the puppet of the Ukrainian government." She declined to comment further. Nearby, a man dressed in a full traditional shepherd outfit made fun of Orbán's supporters. With a serious face and a slight twinkle in his eye, he told local reporters to keep an eye on his, quote, flock, i.e., Fidesz voters, before, saying he was very disappointed with Mr. Orbán. Among those expressing frustration with Mr. Orbán was Akos, a resident of a nearby Fidesz voting village, who declined to give his last name for fear of reprisals. He expects his neighbors and parents to vote Fidesz, a sign of deep rural and generational divides. Fidesz remains particularly strong in rural areas and among older voters, especially those over 60. Many in this segment of society have benefited from a range of government policies under Mr. Orbán, including generous pension increases, utility price caps, tax breaks for families, and rural development programs. Fidesz's message is not credible to us, insists Akos. It's the same posters all the time: Brussels, war, hatred. There is no good reason to vote for him. We are biting the hand that is feeding us when we attack Brussels. By way of example, ever since Brussels stopped sending funds to Hungary, Akos says, roads are in bad shape. His village is part of the Hungarian Village Program, a government initiative launched in 2019 to support rural communities. He says the program now produces sloppy repair work with new layers of pavement laid over old ones, raising roads to the point they overlook people's gardens. But his family does not draw the same link between economic decline and poor relations with Brussels. And security is their chief concern. "My parents are actually afraid of war," he says, shaking his head. "When I try to convince my mother to vote against Orbán, she starts crying and saying, 'I can't believe I have to hear this from you.'" For Mr. Mraz, the government strategy remains effective. "You need a strong leadership in turbulent times," is a solid offer, he says. The real challenge for Fidesz is the potential of protest voting that is a normal phenomenon in a democracy after 16 years in power. The question is whether Magyar can upscale this and unite all the opposition sentiment behind his own party. Dr. Botoni, the historian, says Mr. Orbán's fear-mongering as a strategy is getting stale. He also sees darker undertones of anti-Semitism in the campaign's harsh focus on Mr. Zelensky as the anchor point of broader fear-mongering. He recalls previous campaigns against George Soros, a billionaire philanthropist who has long been a target of government-backed messaging in Hungary. While Mr. Magyar is a Christian, both Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Soros are Jewish. They're running against Volodymyr Zelensky because they can't admit the fact that Péter Magyar is untouchable, so if they try to harm the guy that some people could still hate in Hungary, like they did Soros, Dr. Botoni says. In Dr. Botoni's assessment, Mr. Orbán is panicking. He points to March 15th as a turning point in the campaign. On that day, rival rallies were held in Budapest to mark the 1848 revolution. The opposition turnout exceeded that of Fidesz by at least several tens of thousands, according to independent media reports. That was an alarm bell for Orbán. Still, loyalty to the prime minister remains firm among many voters. Nemeth Gergely, a 62-year-old farmer and fourth-generation landowner, says his support for Mr. Orbán is unwavering. He has voted for Fidesz since its years in opposition in the early 2000s and remains loyal today. He was among the farmers who came to Győr and polished tractors with light-up signs spelling Fidesz. In his view, Mr. Orbán is safeguarding Hungary's security from European Union policies while also strengthening the country's economic position by pursuing market opportunities with Russia. Everyone tries to exploit us, he concludes, but Orbán is the best prime minister. There is no one like him. He protects his people until the end. And again, this particular article is by Dominique Sogoy, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor. This one reads, despite White House rhetoric, Iran campaign reveals U.S. dependency on Europe. The war in Iran is showing that Europe has more leverage over the United States than its leaders had thought. But can they use it? The date on this article is April the 6th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Berlin. Throughout most of Donald Trump's second term as president of the United States, Europe's leaders have seemed bullied, belittled, and marginalized. Then came the Iran war. For the first time since Mr. Trump returned to office, Europe is proving essential to the president's interests. Without access to European bases, the war in Iran would be orders of magnitude more difficult, if not impossible. Meanwhile, an outburst at a March 26 White House cabinet meeting indicated just how bitterly Mr. Trump wants Europe to do more to join the fight. Quote, "We are very disappointed with NATO because NATO has done absolutely nothing," he said. For once, it appears Europe has the leverage. And this comes only months after Europe stood up to Mr. Trump on his claims to Greenland, forcing the president to back down. Europe, it seems, has arrived at a moment when it can at least somewhat readjust the balance of power. On one hand, the Trump administration has likely realized that Europe is vital to its security interests and that acting alone has consequences when the road turns rough. Yet Europe's unwillingness to do more to capitalize on the situation speaks to the core challenges facing modern Europe. Leaders seem to be scared of what Mr. Trump might do in return and therefore too divided to settle on a clear course of action. This, ironically, is one reason Mr. Trump has been so dismissive of Europe. While he has been able to centralize significant power, allowing him wide scope for decisive actions, Europe remains a comparatively fractious collection of nations more comfortable with incremental steps. But if Iran shows one thing that has changed, it is that Europe is slowly growing a thicker skin. Leaders are still trying to work with Mr. Trump, hoping they can keep their historical ties to the U.S. intact. But experts say they are no longer terrified by every statement and social media post. Europe has realized a lot of these threats are empty, says Matthias Matijas, senior fellow for Europe at the Council on Foreign Relations. There is a little more shrug of the shoulders. In 2025, there was immediate panic. Iran has been an example of how this new balancing act plays out. European leaders seem convinced that the joint U.S.-Israeli campaign has virtually no chance of overthrowing the Iranian regime. It is casting the region and energy markets into chaos for no real purpose, they argue. Not only that, it is widely unpopular. A poll by German TV station ARD found that 58% of respondents said the war was not justified, with 75% worried that it will spread to other countries. Trust in the U.S. fell to 15%, the lowest level in two decades. Polls around Europe show similar results. Leaders are avoiding appearing connected to the war, but it affects them and is of great importance to Mr. Trump. The answer has been to distance themselves from the war, but let the United States use their European bases. The U.S. is running various operations from England, France, Italy, Greece, Portugal, and Germany. Ramstein Air Base in Germany is an example of how crucial European bases are to the operation. Many of the American military's regional information technology-based operations are run from Ramstein, including artificial intelligence activities. It is a hub for targeting control, says Ulrich Kuhn, an analyst for the Institute for Peace Research and Security Policy in Hamburg, Germany. In recent years, he adds, the base has even increased in importance when conducting a war in the Middle East. Several countries have also sought to offer help under specific conditions. This includes the potential deployment of minesweepers to the Strait of Hormuz once hostilities are over. Apart from Spain, which refused to allow its bases to be used for the war, most European countries have conspicuously avoided extremes. They have not openly condemned the U.S., nor have they asked for concessions for the use of their bases. One great concern is Mr. Trump's unpredictable nature, in particular on Ukraine. He has shown only lukewarm support for that war, and some worry that upsetting him could lead him to act on threats of backing out or abandoning Europe. They're afraid that if they push the envelope, it will end up a self-fulfilling prophecy when he does those things, says Dr. Kuhn. But, as a practical matter, Europe isn't united enough to use leverage the way Mr. Trump does, he adds. That's not how Europe operates. For now, Europe seems to be mostly hoping the lessons of the Iran war might sink in. It's the first time the members of the Trump administration genuinely realize they need Europe, says Dr. Mattis. There is something to be said for building coalitions. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Still in today's world section of The Monitor, our next headline reads, China, a leader in renewables, was prepared for a global fuel crisis. The conflict could be a boon for China's new energy sector, including renewable energy, electric vehicles, and batteries. The date on this article is April the 3rd. It is by Ann Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and that dateline is Beijing. Lines of cars clogged streets near gas stations across Beijing last week as drivers scrambled to fill up their tanks before an announced price hike. Electric scooters and bicycles weaved around the idle vehicles. Everyone's impacted by the increase, sighed one fuel attendant in the red and blue uniform of China Sinopec, a large state-run oil and gas company, as she helped a customer fill up on Monday. She pointed to the lit-up digital pump, showing the new price, about $4.90 a gallon, an increase of roughly 50 cents. Overall, China is well-positioned to buffer its consumers and economy from the oil shock sparked by the Iran war, despite its heavy dependency on imported oil. To be sure, if the war drags on and leads to a global recession, China's growth, which depends heavily on exports, would take a serious hit. But, barring that, signs are emerging that the war could boost China's economic heft relative to other countries as Beijing leverages its robust oil reserves, refining capacity, diversified energy sector, and clean energy industry dominance. China has a lot of leverage because it is shielded from the shock, while the rest of the world is not, says Alice Garcia Herrero, a senior fellow at Bruegel, a Brussels-based economic think tank. In recent years, China has built up sizable oil reserves in part by importing discounted oil from sanctioned countries such as Russia, Venezuela, and Iran. Iranian oil has flowed to China through a shadow network that involves transshipments via third countries like Malaysia, payments using Chinese yuan instead of U.S. dollars, then processing by China's small private teapot refineries, some with rounded tanks and spout-like pipes. China's reserve totaled around 1.3 billion barrels at the start of 2026. Even with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the loss of imports from Venezuela, that amount of oil could still last for the next 2 years, according to estimates from Gavekal Dragonomics, a research firm focused on China's economy. Such reserves are helping the government ease the oil price shock for hundreds of millions of Chinese who drive gas-fueled cars and trucks. In a rare intervention to quell panic buying, the National Reform and Development Commission last week imposed temporary gasoline and diesel retail price controls for the first time since 2013. The move was necessary to mitigate the impact of an abnormal rise in international oil prices, the NRDC said in a statement. Price violations would be punished strictly, it warned. The government adjusts oil prices every 10 days, and the next price change comes April 7th. For China, a little upward price pressure is actually a good thing, experts say. Unlike the U.S., where inflation is raging, China has grappled with deflation in recent years. China can afford some increase in oil prices, says Dr. Herrero, who specializes in emerging markets with a focus on Asia. China's large reserves and refining capacity, coupled with its diversified energy sources, also put it in a relatively strong position compared with the rest of Asia. In a possible sign of Beijing's increased leverage, the Philippines and China last week reopened talks on potential joint oil and gas exploration in the South China Sea, despite their ongoing territorial disputes there. The Philippines, which imports more than 90% of its oil from the Middle East, has declared a national emergency and soaring fuel prices amid soaring fuel prices and rapidly shrinking reserves. And Beijing's decision in mid-March to ban jet fuel exports, a way to ration its reserves and manage surging airfare, risks shortages in countries such as Australia, which bought a third of its jet fuel from China in 2025. The overall situation is that we're seeing is countries are desperate in trying to secure energy supplies, be it oil or gas or other sources of energy, says Li Shu, director of China Climate Hub at the Asia Society Policy Institute, ASPI, in Washington. While countries including China may restart or ramp up coal plants or pivot to other sources of fossil fuels in the short run, in the medium term, they are also likely to promote more renewable energy such as wind and solar, says Mr. Li. It vindicates this longstanding Chinese approach, he says. Many countries are pivoting to China's playbook. China's main source of energy consumption remains coal, followed by crude oil and natural gas, and a growing share of renewables such as hydropower, solar, and wind. The country produces more wind power than any other nation by far. China also dominates key green energy industries such as solar panels, batteries, and electric vehicles. The Iran war is likely to bolster China's transition to electric vehicles, as well as its exports of green energy goods to the rest of the world, in particular the Global South. This will obviously give an extra push to China's energy transition, says Ma Jun, founder and director of the Institute of Public and Environmental Affairs, a Beijing nonprofit. And once again, this particular article is by Ann Scott Tyson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Still in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Maduro is gone. Venezuela is still waiting for meaningful change. 3 months after the U.S. military captured its authoritarian leader, Venezuela is seeing some change. But any big shift in political or economic life will come slowly. The date on this article is April the 3rd. It is by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and Valentina Gill, who is a special contributor at The Monitor. The datelines are Mexico City and Caracas, Venezuela. When Jordan Flores walked into Venezuela's presidential offices for a news conference on March 6th, it was the first time in his nearly decades-long career as a journalist that the media was invited inside the pink walls of Miraflores Palace. For more than 20 years, the Venezuelan government tightened its grip on civil liberties, including freedom of the press, by shuttering news outlets, revoking broadcast licenses, and blocking online news content. For a political reporter like Mr. Flores, the opportunity last month to stand just a few feet away from Venezuela's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, and U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum felt historic. And none of it would have happened, Mr. Flores says, without the U.S.-led operation to capture Venezuela's authoritarian leader and former president, Nicolas Maduro, on January the 3rd. In the 3 months that have passed since the U.S. military carried out strikes in Caracas and ferried Mr. Maduro off to a detention center in the United States, there have been important changes in Venezuela's political, civic, and economic life. Inflation is still driving up the cost of living, but the government passed sweeping hydrocarbons reform that would make investing in Venezuela more appealing to international companies, especially now that the U.S. has lifted oil sanctions. Authorities have also loosened their grip on free expression by allowing local and international journalists into the presidential palace, permitting public protests, and passing an amnesty law for political prisoners. Venezuelans say they are feeling hopeful in ways that few imagined possible when they rang in the new year this year with Mr. Maduro at the helm. They have very high expectations, says Menino Alarcón Deza, a Venezuelan political scientist and former director of the Center for Political and Government Studies at the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello, a Catholic university in Caracas. But there's fear that this moment won't solidify into a democratic reality, he says. Mr. Alcaron refers to something he calls learned fear after several events in recent years raised expectations for change, such as the 2024 presidential election, which showed overwhelming support for the political opposition, but never actually delivered on those expectations. The high hopes sparked by these recent shifts inside the country are important, experts say, but most of the changes since January 3rd aren't structural and could be easily reversed. A presidential election is, in theory, on the horizon for Venezuelans, but no date has been set, and Ms. Rodriguez could benefit from its delay. On January 3rd, the dictator was taken out of Venezuela, but we maintain a dictatorship, says Paola Bautista de Aleman, director of Venezuela's Institute of Political Studies, FORMA, and a public policy fellow at the University of Notre Dame. Despite the easing of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela after Mr. Maduro's ouster, economic relief for much of the citizenry has not yet materialized. Prices for base goods are climbing, and Venezuela still maintains the highest annualized inflation rate in the world, estimated at around 600%. Since January 3rd, Venezuela's currency has lost nearly 20% of its value against the U.S. dollar. The grim economic picture is slightly tempered by people's hope that change is coming. What is not clear, though, is how long they are willing to wait to feel a real difference in their lives. The U.S. government said in February it had returned $500 million to Venezuela for an initial sale of oil following Mr. Maduro's capture. Members of the public are starting to ask why that hasn't affected the minimum wage, which has been locked in at 130 bolivars, about 28 cents per month, since 2022. According to Sendes FVM, a research center for the union representing Venezuelan teachers, in February, the cost of a basic food basket was nearly $650 for a family of five, costing well more than 2,000 times the minimum wage. On March 12th, hundreds of workers and retirees took to the streets in Caracas to demand a higher minimum wage. "Tired of trying to make my salary do magic," one protest sign read. To the surprise of many, protesters were allowed to reach their intended destination, the National Assembly. During Mr. Maduro's nearly 13 years in power, those who dared step out to protest in public were met with a violent response from government security forces. In 2024, following the internationally contested presidential election that Mr. Maduro claimed without evidence to have won, thousands of people were imprisoned for taking part in demonstrations. Since January 3rd, citizens have become emboldened to speak up. "We've lost our fear," says Emilio Rodriguez, a retiree who joined protesters for a subsequent minimum wage protest on March 25th. He said he stretches his income of roughly 60 cents per month, like Plato, the furthest I can. The sense that the U.S. is pressuring Venezuela's leadership to change is part of what is feeding a renewed sense of hope. "The government has no choice but to heed our request because the one setting the agenda is the U.S. government," says Genesis, a protester who declined to give her last name, instead offering an alias, the grandmother of the resistance. Unlike the early March protests that made it to the National Assembly, subsequent marches on March 23rd and March 25th were pushed off course by the National Police. They weren't violent, but this was a reminder that Ms. Rodriguez's administration might only be going through the motions of loosening restrictions on free expression. Mr. Flores, the journalist, felt similarly about his visit to Miraflores Palace. When he first arrived, he was told he, as well as many other local reporters, was not on the list and would not be allowed entry. Eventually, it was the U.S. government employees who put pressure on the Venezuelan press office that got him permission to attend the news conference. The whole day felt like a reflection of this current political climate, Mr. Flores says, the government feigning openness while secretly maintaining its old ways. He says the same trend has been repeated since January 3rd, including a new amnesty law. In theory, the February amnesty, hold on one second here, applies to all political offenses committed after 1999 when Mr. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, rose to power through 2026. However, the law was passed by the National Assembly without input from the opposition, and observers say it has not been fully enacted. Some 700 political prisoners have been released to the great relief of their loved ones, but hundreds more are still languishing in detention. There have been people denied amnesty, and what's worse is that more than 10,000 people have tried to access the judicial benefits, says Dr. Bautista. That means the rough count that the opposition had for the number of political prisoners in detention under the Maduro administration, about 2,000 in total, was so far off what is emerging as the reality that the black box of human rights violations in our country is still unopened, she says. One well-known political prisoner arrested in July 2021 and accused of terrorism was released in February. But by March, the government announced it was denying amnesty to Javier Tarazona, who directed an organization tracking abuses by the Venezuelan military and Colombian armed groups along the border. He continues to protest publicly despite the risk. We haven't seen real structural changes from the government, but we are seeing the courage and persistence of the people, says Dr. Bautista. Since the contested 2024 presidential election, many Venezuelans hoped that if Mr. Maduro were removed from office, the opposition would automatically step into power. The U.S. recognized Venezuelan opposition candidate Edmundo González as the winner of that election, despite Mr. Maduro's claiming victory. And opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who was barred by the government from running, was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize last year for advancing democracy inside Venezuela. But in January, U.S. President Donald Trump put power in the hands of Ms. Rodriguez, Mr. Maduro's former vice president, not the popular opposition. That decision was reportedly based on the advice of the CIA, which determined that only someone close to Mr. Maduro could control the military and police forces and thereby maintain stability. The Trump administration has said its ultimate goal is to restore democracy in Venezuela, but no election date has been set. Many here believe Ms. Rodriguez is already ramping up her campaign efforts from inside the presidential palace, trying to paint herself as a reformist ushering in a new post-Maduro era. It's in her interest, experts say, to delay elections as long as possible, in part so that there is a better chance of seeing economic improvements before the next election. There will have to be free and fair elections in Venezuela, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on March 31st. We have to be patient, but we also can't be complacent. After being closed for 7 years, the U.S. Embassy officially reopened operations in Caracas at the end of March. This could allow the U.S. to push along an electoral timetable, and that would require reforming the Electoral Council, which is currently stacked with Maduro allies. What kind of country will emerge after all of this, asks Dr. Bautista. I don't think anybody knows, but it's clear the driving force of change inside the country is the courage and the hope of the Venezuelan people. And again, this particular article was written by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and Valentina Gill, who is a special contributor at The Monitor. And here's one final headline from today's World section of The Monitor. It reads, "The Iran War and International Law. Fears grow of, quote, age of impunity." The Iran war is the latest conflict to see blows to principles of international law, rules of war, and protections for civilian populations. The date on this article is April the 2nd. It is by Neb Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor. The dateline is London. 2 or 3 weeks was President Trump's timetable delivered from the White House Wednesday night for ending the war in Iran. And America's allies in the Middle East and worldwide will be fervently hoping he proves right. But a specific threat in his 19-minute address, initially made 2 weeks ago and promptly matched by Iran, is alarming longtime partners, especially member states of the increasingly strained transatlantic NATO alliance. It's not just the tone of the tit-for-tat threats, but their declared target, energy and desalination plants across Iran and in U.S.-allied Arab states in the Gulf. The prospect of attacking facilities on which tens of millions of people rely has spotlighted an issue that they feel has implications beyond the Iran conflict, no matter how and when it ends. It's best captured by the official rubric of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1950, a key part of the international rules of warfare agreed upon after World War II, the protection of civilian persons in time of war. The threats to critical civilian infrastructure have deepened concerns that the Iran war is dealing a major new blow to long-accepted norms governing how and when nations should be able to wage war. Actions prescribed include attacks on civilians or civilian infrastructure without a demonstrable military justification. That legal framework has been eroding for more than a decade. Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad's targeting of rebel-held areas with chemical weapons and barrel bombs during the country's civil war prompted warnings at the time of an era of impunity for attacks on civilians. Russian President Vladimir Putin has since shrugged off the need for protection of civilian persons in Ukraine. Russia has fired thousands of missiles and drones at energy facilities, apparently hoping to cow the civilian population into submission. The scale of destruction in Gaza from the Israelis' retaliation for Hamas's October 2023 kidnapping and killing has also provoked accusations they've violated international law. Yet the Iran war is being viewed as a challenge of a different order because America was not only a supporter but a prime architect of the rules-based order forged since World War II. The absence of military support from key U.S. allies has been only partly because they were kept in the dark about the war plans or due to Mr. Trump's alternately dismissive and hostile treatment of them since he returned to office. Nor is it down to sympathy for the regime in Tehran. Allied leaders have stressed that they share Mr. Trump's view that Iran is repressive at home, violently destabilizing abroad, and should not be allowed to get a nuclear weapon. Yet, a number of allies have questioned his claim to have launched the war because of an imminent threat from Iran, the kind of preemptive attack that might pass muster under the UN Charter. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney called the war inconsistent with international law. Political leaders in other Western states, including NATO members France, Spain, Norway, and neutral Switzerland, have voiced that view. Their hope will be that Mr. Trump's reference in his White House address to continuing diplomatic contacts means a negotiated off-ramp might yet be found. United States allies have signaled a readiness to join in policing a reopened Strait of Hormuz, the waterway through which a significant part of the world's supply of oil, gas, fertilizer, and other materials passes, but only if that follows an internationally negotiated arrangement to reopen it. The fear, however, is of a new escalation and a new challenge to the civilian safeguards in the Fourth Geneva Convention, expanded in 1997, and in a further UN-sanctioned statute in 1998. They have raised that concern in response to a move by America's Iran war partner Israel to reoccupy southern Lebanon, clear border villages of civilians, and possibly destroy homes as part of a campaign to disarm the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia. In a statement this week, European foreign ministers held Hezbollah ultimately responsible for having joined the war and fired into Israel. But they called for protection of the civilian population, humanitarian personnel, peacekeepers, and civilian infrastructure, including airports, ports, and bridges, across the country in line with international humanitarian law. That could prove an even higher hurdle if the United States and Iran act on their threats. In a March 21 ultimatum, President Trump gave Iran 48 hours to open the Strait of Hormuz, or he would, quote, obliterate the country's energy plants. He has since extended the deadline until April 6 and gave no specific time limit in his White House address. But he did say that if no deal is made in the next few weeks, U.S. forces will hit each and every one of their electric generating plants very hard and probably simultaneously. Iran responded to the initial ultimatum by threatening to attack power and desalination plants in the Arab Gulf states, an especially dire prospect for their populations, which depend on desalination for fresh water far more than the Iranians. Iran's reply to Mr. Trump's latest address was to threaten more crushing, broader, and more destructive actions. For Mr. Carney, the Iran war has vindicated a message he's been delivering for months now, that the world order is dominated by self-interest, great power hegemons, and the old rules-based order isn't returning. But his call for fellow middle powers to wield their collective weight in response could provide a clue to post-war efforts to keep at least some of the rules of war alive. In a high-profile speech weeks before the Iran war, he urged a mixture of pragmatism and fundamental values. Those values, Mr. Carney said, include sovereignty and territorial integrity, the prohibition of the use of force except when consistent with the UN Charter, and respect for human rights. And again, this particular article was written by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor. All right. We're off to the USA section now, and our first headline reads, Artemis II reignites deep space travel. Will it also boost a lunar economy? The Artemis II crew made history Monday, reaching the farthest distance humans have ever traveled from the Earth. NASA and its commercial partners aim to also pioneer a new space economy through the Artemis missions. The date on this article is April the 7th. It is by Henry Gass, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Houston. The crew of the Artemis II set a record Monday for the farthest distance humans have traveled from Earth as the spacecraft swung around the far side of the moon. Shortly after traveling 248,656 miles away from Earth, breaking the record set by Apollo 13 in 1970, Artemis mission specialist Jeremy Hansen said he and his crewmates choose this moment to challenge this generation and the next to make sure this record is not long-lived. NASA and its partners in the commercial U.S. space industry are counting on the Artemis mission to break records and garner enough popular support to help usher in a new era of space exploration, one that is fueled by a thriving space economy. To accomplish that goal, NASA is testing a strategy of relying more heavily on public-private partnerships. For Artemis II, that has meant partnering with traditional contractors like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. For future Artemis missions, partnerships are to include SpaceX and Blue Origin and other newcomers like Firefly Aerospace, a Texas-based private space company that successfully landed a spacecraft on the lunar surface in March 2025. Where once only governments could afford the eye-watering sums associated with reaching outer space, private companies like SpaceX have helped turn rocket launches into a relatively cheap, profitable business. Meanwhile, companies like Firefly are designing rovers and landers for NASA and other customers to explore the lunar surface and help build a permanent lunar outpost in the near future. Firefly Aerospace is one of thousands of private space companies that now make up the commercial space industry. As of 2021, there were over 10,000 companies in the industry, Forbes reported, with a total value in excess of $4 trillion. NASA is hoping that the future of space exploration is built on public-private partnerships with several of these companies. The Artemis program, which will involve partnerships with multiple private companies in future missions, is a glimpse into that future. However, while the commercial space sector has certainly grown, it is not as big or as profitable as NASA officials hoped it would be by this point. The lunar economy could be worth around $170 billion over the next two decades, according to a 2021 analysis by PricewaterhouseCoopers. But as it stands today, there are some hard economic realities, like lack of current profitability, standing between private industry and that kind of lucrative space economy, according to experts. Still, there is excitement, particularly following NASA's announcement in late March of a new plan to gradually build a permanent base on the moon, starting with returning humans to the lunar surface in 2028 with Artemis IV. The landing spacecraft for that mission are being built by private companies. When the Blue Ghost touched down last year, it felt like starting something new, says Kevin Schultz, a future systems architect at Firefly Aerospace, in an interview on Monday. It felt like we were getting the tremendous privilege, with a lot of help from NASA, to start a new chapter in space exploration, he said. The government paving the way for private industry to turn a profit has happened previously. The most apt comparison might be the settlement of the American West, which the government facilitated through friendly contracts with railroad companies. A similar trend has happened in low Earth orbit. During the Apollo era in the 60s and 70s, only NASA, or put another way, taxpayers, could pay the cost of entry into space. Private companies, led by billionaire Elon Musk's SpaceX, have helped slash the cost of launches by about 70% through developing reusable rockets and lighter payloads. Now, private rocket launches into low Earth orbit are routine, but these launches often serve one purpose, to deploy new communications satellites into orbit. Now we're incredibly dependent on satellite communication, says Angel Aboud Madrid, director of the Center for Space Resources at Colorado School of Mines. But if the space economy is going to be worth trillions of dollars in the future, he adds, you're going to have to get more revenue streams. Other ventures, once seen as building blocks for a space economy, have fallen flat. The market for space tourism, for example, seems to have dried up amid high costs and a lack of demand. At an event in late March announcing the agency's pivot to focusing on a moon base, NASA officials bemoaned the slow progress of private efforts to create a commercial space station in low Earth orbit. The agency had been planning to decommission the International Space Station by 2030. This is a real challenge. This is a real problem, says Amit Kshatriya, NASA Associate Administrator, at the event a week before the Artemis II launch. Having our presence in low Earth orbit is a national imperative, he adds, but the current industry that we have that's proposing to build destinations does not have the direct experience with that or the resources to go do it. The economic viability of commercial operations in cislunar space, meaning the region extending from Earth's atmosphere to the lunar surface and beyond, might be even more remote. For one, the moon is 100 times farther away from our planet than low Earth orbit. Secondly, as of right now, there is no profit to be found. Surveys have found potentially useful resources on the lunar surface. Rare earth elements used to power many modern devices have been found on the moon. So has helium-3, an isotope that could be used in nuclear fusion, cryogenics, and quantum computing. Extremely rare on Earth, helium-3 has been scattered across the moon by solar winds for billions of years. Potentially the most valuable lunar resource is water. Ice, a resource that is chemically different from ice on Earth and could be vital for human missions and settlements. Found mostly on the lunar South Pole in permanently shadowed craters, the deposits could, in theory, be turned into rocket propellant and oxygen for breathing. Finding a way to efficiently mine and process this lunar ice could, in theory, turn the moon into a self-sustaining gas station for deep space exploration. You can then start lowering the transportation costs, says Dr. Aboud Madrid, then you start opening up cislunar space. But If that is to become reality, a lot of science has to happen first, experts say. Science such as what Artemis II conducted with its lunar flyby Monday, when the crew became the first humans to directly view some areas of the far side of the moon in daylight. The crew spent roughly the seven-hour flyby photographing and cataloging features of the surface in detail. They had 35 targets for 10 science objectives, including identifying potential future landing sites. We need more science characterizations of the moon, says Scott Pace, director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. There's water on the moon, but that's like saying there's gold in the West. Several private companies are gearing up for a gold rush. Three companies, Interlune, Black Moon Energy, and Magna Petra, are focusing on helium-3 mining. Colorado-based Lunar Outpost is building vehicles it says could transport the construction and operation of a permanent lunar base. While these possible ventures have major financial question marks around them, there are also legal, environmental, and even moral consequences, analysts say. For example, what would be the rules for a lunar economy? The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 says the moon cannot be taken over by any nation, but doesn't explicitly ban mining of its resources. The Artemis Accords, a U.S.-led guidance on best practices for the civil exploration and use of outer space, signed by 61 nations, affirms that resource extraction in outer space is lawful, provided certain conditions are met. China and Russia, which are planning to build a permanent base together at the moon's south pole, are not signatories to the Artemis Accords. This doesn't mean a lunar turf warfare is inevitable, experts say. The International Space Station has proved that foreign governments can collaborate in space despite tensions on Earth, but a space station is very different from a planetary body with potentially lucrative resources. If everyone wants to go to the South Pole and everyone wants to have a base there, there's going to have to be some conversation, says Dr. Aboud Madrid. And this is a good time to do it, he adds. All of these things have to be addressed before we start on a massive scale. In the meantime, Artemis II has begun its journey back to Earth. The crew is scheduled to splash down off the coast of San Diego on Friday. 2026 is also scheduled to be a busy year for commercial moonshots. Three companies, in partnership with NASA, are scheduled to land scientific payloads on the lunar surface, including a second Blue Ghost mission by Firefly Aerospace. Mr. Schultz describes the competition between all these companies as a friendly rivalry. We compete over the same contracts, we compete over the same missions, he says, but ultimately we're in the same industry. All ships are going to rise and sink with the tide, he adds. We love it when our competitors succeed because it means more opportunity for everyone. And once again, this particular article is by Henry Gass, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Continuing on in the USA section, our next headline reads, if U.S. bombs Iranian infrastructure, could it be a war crime? Not at all, Trump says. Iran ceasefire talks continue as President Trump's deadline looms and questions mount over whether strikes on infrastructure could be war crimes. The date on this article is April 6. It is by Anna Mulring-Grobe, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. As the White House's deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz amid reports that Tehran has rejected the latest ceasefire proposal, President Donald Trump intensified his rhetoric on Monday, warning that the entire country can be taken out in one night, and that might be tomorrow night. Mr. Trump alternately threatened to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age and touted significant and imminent prospects for peace during a midday news conference. A reporter asked the president whether he is winding down the U.S. war or ramping it up. I can't tell you, he said. Was he concerned that carrying out threats to bomb Iran's civilian infrastructure could constitute a war crime, as some experts in international humanitarian law have suggested? Not at all, the president replied, adding, I hope we don't have to do it. On the podium, Mr. Trump had gathered cabinet officers to share details of the rescue of a U.S. airman this past weekend involving hundreds of troops, including Special Operations Forces. It was an incredibly brave and courageous mission, said Air Force General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Having the guts to try means so much to so many. The culmination of the promise of U.S. military forces to leave no one behind did not appear to temper the president's resentment of the Iranian regime, however, or of the journalist who broke the news last week of the downed U.S. fighter jet and missing service member that set off an Iranian search. The person who did that story will go to jail if they don't reveal their source, President Trump said. Hours after the airman was rescued on Easter Sunday, flying across the Iranian border into safe territory just after midnight, Mr. Trump issued an expletive-laden social media post threatening to blow up Iran's bridges and power plants unless it reopened the Strait of Hormuz. It was on March 26 that Mr. Trump set a 10-day deadline for Iran to reopen the strait, where traffic has been largely halted since the U.S. and Israel attacked 5 weeks ago. Over the weekend, he extended that deadline by 3 days to today, April 7th, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Mr. Trump said on Monday that he did this because Iran had asked for an extension. I can't talk about the ceasefire, but I can tell you that we have an active, willing participant on the other side, he said. Egyptian, Pakistani, and Turkish envoys are said to have submitted a proposal for a 45-day ceasefire and a reopening of the strait. It's not good enough, but it's a very significant step, Mr. Trump told reporters on the sidelines of the White House Easter egg roll on Monday. The regime, for its part, has remained defiant and perhaps emboldened by help it is reportedly receiving from China in the form of satellite images of U.S. military assets in the Middle East, enhanced by artificial intelligence that could be helping Tehran target U.S. forces, some analysts say. Iranian leaders said they will reopen the critical waterway only after the U.S. pays reparations for war-related damages and energy losses throughout the country. The plan would put in place a new protocol requiring certain ships to pay a fee, in some cases up to $2 million, according to reports, for transitioning the straits. What about us charging tolls, Mr. Trump said on Monday? Why shouldn't we? We're the winner. During his turn at the lectern on Monday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth took the rescue of the downed F-15E weapons officer as an opportunity to taunt Iran. The airman was under constant threat by Iranian forces closing in, Mr. Hegseth said. Ultimately, it was an impotent Iranian threat. He adds, Iran is embarrassed and humiliated, and they should be. The weekend mission to extract the downed airman was high risk and involved 155 aircraft. At least three of those aircraft were hit by what the president on Monday called very, very heavy Iranian fire. Injured after ejecting from his jet after it was struck, the downed flyer reportedly climbed 7,000 feet and nestled in a rock crevice as he awaited extraction from deep within enemy lines. Another U.S. military pilot whose aircraft was hit during the rescue mission managed to keep control of his plane until reaching Kuwaiti airspace before ejecting and being rescued. Mr. Trump did share plans that he says are already in place where every bridge in Iran will be decimated by 12 midnight tomorrow night, and every power plant will be demolished if there is no peace deal. As though to encounter the Trump always chickens out or tacos sobriquet, the president said that after Iran shut down a prospective ceasefire last week, he gave an order to destroy Iran's largest bridge. Within 10 minutes after I gave that order, the bridge was down, he said. The strike on the newly built suspension bridge between Tehran and Karaj, one of Tehran's premier infrastructure projects, killed 8 people. Some U.S. military analysts have raised concerns that the threats to hit civilian infrastructure such as bridges and power plants could, if carried out, constitute war crimes under the Geneva Conventions. Mr. Trump's advisors have reportedly countered that roads and electricity are valid military targets. The U.S. military lawyers are often split on such questions. There are things that can be rock-solid legal or threadbare legal because you can probably find a DOD lawyer someplace that will say it's legal. Mr. Trump said he would not strike Iranian power plants, particularly since we may even get involved by helping them rebuild their nation. But he added on Monday that he is not concerned about the impact of potential massive strikes on Iran's civilian population. He claimed that when U.S. bomb strikes stop, Iranian civilians tell him that they are upset and ask the United States to please come back. They would be willing to suffer that in order to suffer that in order to have freedom, President Trump said. And once again, this particular article was by Anna Mulring Grobe, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And with that, we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you spending some of your valuable time with me, listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with you with more from the Christian Science Monitor at the end of this week. Thank you for listening.